It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We'll talk about the upcoming Pwn2Own contest. You won't believe what the hackers are being axed to attack next. We also have details on Steve's favorite OpenVPN client for Android and a good reason to be very careful about which banking tools you use on Android. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 698, recorded Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. Which mobile VPN client? Security Now is brought to you by Thinxt Canary. Detect attackers on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in How Did You Hear About Us. And by Wasabi, hot cloud storage. Wasabi offers next-generation cloud storage with the highest possible durability and security. See for yourself, with free unlimited storage for a month, go to wasabi.com, click free trial, and use the offer code SECURITYNOW. And by WordPress, turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at wordpress.com. Get 15% off any new plan at wordpress.com/securitynow. It's time for secure. Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure I'm recording. I am. It's
please do press the red button.
Did yes. I ever not record Security Now?
Once, maybe twice in the entire 13-year history. Oh. We would get all done, and then it was like, ooh. And it's, but you know, I have to say, Leo.
So sorry.
The second time was better than the first time.
It often is.
It was painful, but we did have a dry run rehearsal. So
sorry. Well, that will never happen again because I am no longer in charge of recording shows.
It hasn't happened for a long time.
No, at least a decade. I remember the worst one was a Floss Weekly episode where I erased it twice, and I had to call the guy back for a third time. But we are recording.
So we are closing in on episode 700. We're at 698 today.
It has been a long time.
It'll be the 29th will be the last podcast of the month. So, you know, next Friday. But
your first podcast in February.
A piece of news that Bleeping Computer ran caught my attention because it was about the 150 bad VPN clients in the Google Play Store. And I thought, what? Well, first of all, that there were bad ones, I guess that wasn't that big a surprise, but that there were 150 VPN clients, just I couldn't believe it. So there is only one. And I thought, okay, we're going to call this podcast, Which Mobile VPN Client? We're going to answer that question once and for all for the ages, Leo. What, if you want to use a VPN, what client should you use? And of course, what VPN? So that's what we'll get to. But there was a lot of news. There was an extremely worrisome Wi-Fi bug, which affects, if we believe Marvel, that makes the chip, which was found to be defective when they were boasting in their marketing material about their chip being in billions of devices, then this Wi-Fi bug could not be worse. And it's in billions of devices.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not good. So we're going to start with that. Then we've got a new, and you're going to love this one. This one is like in your wheelhouse, a new fun category for the end of March is the forthcoming Pwn2Own competition. And you might be able to guess, but anyway, definitely fun new topic or new category for Pwn2Own. We've got Russia's ongoing failing and flailing efforts to control the internet, and they're now setting their sights on two new players. We talked previously, remember, about how like they tried to block Telegram and what a disaster that was, with them ending up blocking ranges of Google and Amazon's cloud services and making a mess of things. Well, they're now going after a couple more players, probably without much more success. We've got the return of the Anubis Android banking malware, which was found to be using a clever new trick to avoid detection, that I just had to share with our listeners, because it's like, okay, this, I mean, we really are in an unending cat and mouse game here. We've got Google's announcement of their changing policy for phone and SMS app access. They're clamping down. Also, I also wanted to talk about the first thing you guys talked about on Mac Break Weekly, which is Tim Cook's note in Time Magazine.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah.
We also have news of a nice Facebook ad auditing page I wasn't aware of, but it resulted in the creation of the first Bitly link I have created in a long time, SNFBADS. I tried to not have SN in there, but every kind of variation of Facebook or FB or anything was already taken. So it's bit.ly/SNFBADS for anyone who wants to jump ahead. So we're going to talk about that. There's another, believe it or not, Cisco default password nightmare, but this time not in some obscure high-end switch that no one's ever heard of, but in widely used lower-end Soho consumer devices. We've got some errata. I said something last week I'm just so embarrassed about. I can't believe I said it, but we're going to, you know, fix that. We have some miscellany, some listener feedback, and then we're going to answer the age-old and apparently quite confusing question, which is the right VPN client to use for Android? And once we get back from our first break, we need to talk about Oscar's latest DEC PDP reconstruction resurrection, because, boy, this guy has just done an amazing job.
Nice. Well, we got a full lineup of stuff to talk about. I can't wait. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, of course, a word from our sponsor. And I have to say, this is a sponsor I love an awful lot. We, in fact, talked about them on the show years before they ever bought ads. And we're talking about Canary from Thinkst. The Thinkst Canary is a device everybody needs. I had somebody call me on the radio show. Actually, this is an interesting question, which I should forward to you. He was asking about his MPO, you know, his main point of entry. He said, I work in an office building. I don't know if I can trust the office, the office landlord, because our internet connection and everybody else in the building goes into this closet where everything is. Yep. Should I be worried about that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, yeah, I mean, you obviously have to trust them, and I hope it's well secured and that somebody can't just walk in off the street. But honestly, it's not just that closet. You've got internet traffic coming into your business. I said, well, do you have Wi-Fi? He said, yeah. I said, well, forget the MPO. You got a radio broadcasting your stuff out there. One of the things that's really important to do, I told him, you go out and get a consultant to help you set this all up. But one of the most important things to do is to know if somebody is on your network. That's the real, you know, million-dollar question. How do you know if you've been penetrated? And that's where the Thinkst Canary is so cool. Haroon, who runs Thinkst, is a wonderful security guy. In fact, the Canaries were designed by a company that taught, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world and governments, too, how to secure themselves from hackers. And they realized, we need a honeypot. We talked about, practically on the very first Security Now, we talked about honeypots, the idea of putting something on your network that's attractive to the bad guys. And if they touch it in any way, alarms you, right? Tells you, hey, there's somebody in your network. So Thinkst has made honeypots as easy as can be, trivial to deploy, with zero administration overhead. And they call it a canary. Canaries can be set up in under 4 minutes. And within minutes of configuration, your canary will look identical to a router or a Switch or a NAS or ours. Well, the one I have in here is set up to look like a Synology NAS. And of course, I put on there every port's turned on. It's lit up. But you can be more subtle. You know, you could have a Windows box, a server with only one, with one port open. You can even use Canary to generate files, Canary tokens, they call them, that you spread around your network that maybe are named things like payroll spreadsheet or employee social security numbers. Or the thing about Canaries is they don't look vulnerable. They look valuable. They look like something bad guys really want. You can even enroll them in Active Directory. It's a really cool idea. Harun sent us a few messages that they've received, and I'll redact the names because nobody wants you to know they're running Canaries. A lot of people don't anyway, because the whole idea is, well, bad guys will think these are real servers, Cisco switches, things like that. Here's one email. I've been a fan of the Canary since I heard about it on Security Now. Thank you. I thought the idea was awesome. Immediately recommended it to my CISO, my security officer, chief information security officer. We purchased Never, and I have never been more proud of a project. Here's another line. I love your product. Cannot stop talking about them to my counterparts. I'm so glad I listened to Security Now. So thanks, Harun, for passing those on. And I'm glad you're listening to Security Now today because this is a great thing for you to get. I'm just going to show you the interface to my Canary. I got a few alerts last weekend. And then, as you could see, 9 hours ago, my Canary had been disconnected. So even if the Canary gets taken off the network, of course, I freaked out, and then I realized, oh, yeah, Burke's working on my desk, rewiring my desk. That's okay. What's great is, notice this. There are four total alerts: Canary disconnected, Canary reconnected. That's the beauty of the Canary. You're not going to get a bunch of alerts. You're going to get one high-quality alert when it really matters. This is so awesome. I've got Canary tokens, too. This is great. You can create new files that you put out all over the place. Control, create alerts, remote updates, webhooks. I love it. You could do webhooks, by the way. So you could have incident reporting that goes straight to a site, a blog. There's a complete API. You could say what Canary tokens domain you're going to use so it looks like it's natural. You can ignore or whitelist IP addresses. Those guys are okay. So I can configure my Canary to be, I have it currently, file transfer protocol. Port 21 is open. Port 80 is open. Yes, I have a web server on my NAS. Come on in, boys. The web server is wide open. I can have a port scan monitor, a Windows file share. Yeah, 139. Let's leave that open. Steve taught me not to do that. 22 is open. I can configure it for a variety of devices, including the MAC address, which I really like. So right now, it's a Synology, as I mentioned, but I could have it be, and this changes the MAC address to match these manufacturers, IBM, Hewlett-Packard. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to put a Huawei NAS on my network. Let's see what happens when somebody from Huawei starts to log on here. I love this. It could be an Ubuntu LAMP server. It can be a SharePoint login. You can go on and on and on. Have so much fun with this. Let's see. The MAC prefix has been changed. Oh, yeah. I made it a gigabyte motherboard. But look, let's make it a Huawei 5G switch. That seems like that would be attractive to a certain type of hacker. You can change the HTTP skin so that it can look like Joomla or Cups. JBoss is running. I think this thing is incredible. It is so much fun. And honestly, if you're a bad guy and you go on there and you say, oh, look at that. They've got file sharing turned on. I should go inside and see what's in that server. Boom! I'll get an alert. It's so great. The system is very well priced. You don't pay a big upfront cost. You don't buy the Canaries. You license them annually. In fact, that's nice because if a bird breaks, they don't. They're very reliable. I've had this one for a couple of years. They'll just send you a new one easily, fast. The pricing allows you to try a few, scale up as you need them. Some small shops have a couple of Canaries. There are banks with hundreds of them. I will not name names. They're deployed all over the world. In fact, literally on 7 continents. That's right. There's canaries in Antarctica. Who knew? Don't end up on this year's list of top 10 data breaches. Visit canary. I know I'm saving the best for last. Here's the deal. Go to canary.tools/twit. Canary.tools/twit. Just $7,500 a year for 5 canaries. You get your own hosted console. You get upgrades. You get support. You get maintenance for a full year. And if you put the code TWIT, you don't have to put security now. Just put TWIT, because this is the only show you're on. TWIT in the box, the offer code, in the How Did You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price forever. Forever. If you're not happy, they have a very liberal 2-month money-back guarantee. So you have 2 whole months to try it out. Knock on it. Bang on it. Invite hackers in. Let them play with it. You're going to see the value of this on your network. Put canaries everywhere. Canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. I think I'm going to put my canary back to the way it was. It's been working so nicely. Canary.tools/twit. Use the code TWIT. Picture of the week.
So Oscar is someone I've mentioned before.
Yeah.
He's this amazing craftsman. He produced a clone of the venerable Deck PDP-8 initially. And I own several of them.
They're
I talked
over
about it.
Steve's right shoulder right
well, no,
now.
Well, those are actually different.
Oh.
Those are
that's not that
shoot,
kit that you built?
Well, his is Oscar's is different.
Oh.
These the ones over my shoulder were based on the Intersil 6100 chip, which was an actual PDP-8 on a chip.
Oh.
The problem is those are all gone. They're like hen's teeth now. Do hens have teeth? Anyway.
They don't. That's the whole point. Get it? Okay. Rarer than hen's teeth.
I get it.
They got gullets.
So the problem is, if you can't get a PDP-8 on a chip, what are you going to do?
Right.
Well, what you're going to do is you're going to emulate the machine on a Raspberry Pi.
Of course.
So,
which is probably more powerful than a PDP-8 was.
Oh, my God. Yes.
a lot.
Yes. Way faster. So, and in fact, there is a whole underground. Well, I guess they're not really under the ground, but they're off to the side. They're out of the mainstream. That's what we want to say. They're non-mainstream, but they're fascinating people who are keeping old machine architectures alive by creating mature simulations of their architectures. I mean, to the point where they can run the original operating systems and mount disk packs, virtual disk packs, and do everything like you used to, you know, with the raised floor and the air-conditioned environment and everything.
That's awesome.
Okay. So Oscar's first piece of work was a PDP-8. This one is a PDP-11.
This is beautiful. This
is
gorgeous.
Just stunning.
Oh, man.
And
including
toggle
switches on the front.
He did custom injection molding for the toggle switches and the panel.
Wow.
The whole thing is an exact duplicate of the PDP-1170. And in fact, on his page, it's obsolescence is his website. wixsite.com. I have a link in the show notes for anyone who's interested. And for some of our listeners, you will be when you understand, and I don't understand this at all, Leo. I don't get it, that he wants to sell these kits for $250. I mean, he is selling them for $250.
Wow. And
apologizing, he says, I apologize because that's almost $90 more than the PDP-8. But if you knew the upfront cost of making that injection molded case, you would understand it's not because I am turning commercial. This is still very much a hobby project, although one that got slightly out of hand. Anyway, so again, there's a Raspberry Pi behind the panel. So what he did was he exactly duplicated the functioning of the front panel, blinking lights and switches.
This is amazing.
It is just gorgeous. Yeah. Anyway, so he sat with a buddy in front of an actual 1170 and like pushed switches while video recording in order to get any edge cases of the way the actual 1170 front panel operated so that he could exactly emulate it. And then look at the screen on his laptop. That's, he like faked a CRT bezel on his ThinkPad to show like the way a CRT would look with the bezel for the actual console when you're logged in and giving commands to the PDB-11. Now, okay, so there's elegance to both the 8 and the 11. The elegance of the 8, the PDP-8, was, you know, could you make a computer with, you know, 5 AND gates? Okay, well, not quite, but still, you know, remember that the opcode was 3 bits on a PDP-8. So you had a total of eight instructions, and, you know, like there's no subtract. You have to jump through hoops to get pretty much do anything. So the PDP-8 is arguably a perfect platform if you just sort of kind of wanted to like get started to like show someone that the concept of how ones and zeros and with a few instructions, how you can do something. And frankly, I'm stunned by the fact that, you know, there's OS 8 is an operating system for the PDP-8 written with 8 opcodes. I mean, eight instructions. So, okay, but the 11 is different. The 11 is the other end of the spectrum. It is a stunningly elegant instruction set. And it was the birthplace of Unix. It was on a PDP-11 that the C language was born. Thompson and who was the other guy? Ken?
Kernighan
did C. Thompson and Ritchie, yes, did Unix. And they wrote Unix, you know, toggling it in through the front panel because you had to, you know start somewhere.
I have their books, you know, the Unix programming language and the C. I should get this. I even have the source code. You know, they released the source code in a big bind book.
Well, and what's so neat about this is that it's not just a front panel that does nothing. You get all of the PDP-11 code and source. Wow. And OS. Wow. And Unix and everything the way it was back then. So for $250.
I'm ordering it right now. Wow.
You do have to add a Raspberry Pi, but what are those, $40 or something?
Yeah, $35. I got one lying around. Most people do these days.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, I'm afraid we're going to bury Oscar in orders. He is sending me one because I have to have one of these. It's just stunning. So I just wanted to share. I know from the past that our audience was interested in the PDP-8, and that my talking about it and once this is gone, it's gone. We don't know that nobody else in the future is going to ever do this again, but I don't think anyone's going to do it like this. This is a work of art. I mean, this is just a masterpiece. So take a look at the show notes. It's PIDP-11. I didn't check to see whether Google would find it if we put in P, capital P, lowercase I, capital P, capital D, hyphen 11. Let's see what happens. No,
didn't. I think if you just go type obsolescence and PIDP 11, something like that, because the site is obsolescence.wix.com or wixsite.com. So I bet if you added the word obsolescence, that'd find it.
Yep, that brought it up. Obsolescence. Good. PDP 11. Good. And that's anyone awesome. Could find it that way. And oh my God, it's just, you know, what a toy.
I
and
just
so
added my yes. name to his email list because you can't order it directly. You have to email him and all that. Yeah, that would be fun to have here.
He's a good guy. And, yeah. Oh, yeah, I need more blinking lights behind me, Leo.
Well, come on. I tried to get the 8, And he forgot to send it to me. And then by the time he remembered, it was gone. So, right. Oscar, I want one of these. I'll send you the money. Don't worry.
I'm sure Jason could throw this together and get it up and going and have some fun with it.
Oh, it'll be fun. Yeah.
Okay. So on a much more serious note, we have an incredibly widespread Wi-Fi firmware bug, which by all measure affects probably billions of devices. The title of Embedi's disclosure was Remotely Compromised Devices by Using Bugs in Marvel Avastar Wi-Fi from Zero Knowledge to Zero Click Remote Code Execution. Okay, so this is one of the most popular, if not the most popular Wi-Fi chipset on the market. In digging around, I wanted to find out whether it was possible for its firmware to be reflashed, and I could not get an answer. You have to go under NDA with them in order to get access to the you know, pinouts and the programming of the chip. But it's highly unlikely that an SoC, as this is called, a system on a chip, has reflashable firmware, because there would just be no need for it. Or even if it did, you probably can't get to it from the main processor of the system that it's mounted in. You know, you would need to physically hook on a JTAG debugger in order to get to it to reflash the firmware, if it's even possible. So we're probably all stuck with this Wi-Fi chip as it is. But in the process of digging in to see what I could find, I discovered, I mean, it's been selling for a decade. So, I mean, this particular chip, the 88W8897, it's everywhere. It's in the Sony PlayStation 4, the Xbox One, Microsoft Surface laptops use it. Samsung's Chromebooks use it. The Samsung Galaxy J1 smartphones, the Valve Stream Link cast devices, some other laptops. There are consumer routers and embedded devices and other network hardware. So, I mean, it's sort of the go-to Wi-Fi chip. It's what drives it is an embedded RTOS, a real-time operating system known as ThreadX. And there's been some confused reporting about whether the bug is in ThreadX or in the implementation of it. And it looks like it's actually in the implementation, in the code that was written for this real-time operating system. So the story begins late last spring when a researcher, Dennis Selianin, who is with the embedded security firm Embedi that I mentioned before, he was experimenting with fuzzing that very highly popular Wi-Fi chipset. You know, and we've talked about fuzzing before. The idea is, in some cases, you can't find problems by inspection, so what is done is you sort of automate the process. You just throw a whole bunch of stuff at it. And if something you throw at it makes it crash, then you go, ooh, what just happened? So the idea is that's the process known as fuzzing, where you record what you're throwing and you also watch to see if what you threw crashed the chip. And if so, then you say, whoa, and you back up. And then you fuzz again, verify that it's reproducible, and then from there. So basically, you're using just a random process to find edge cases, things that the programmers missed. So he was doing that, and I saw the log. It's like for 4-point-some days of this, and then he found a problem, dug into it. Figured out what was going on, ended up finding 4 problems, 2 of which are critical. And when we say critical, we're not kidding. If any of these Wi-Fi devices that I mentioned are powered up, the bugs he found would allow malicious attackers to force them to execute arbitrary code of the attacker's choice without requiring any action on the part of the device's owner. In other words, this could not be worse. Well, okay, it would be worse if you could do it from Russia. The good news is it is Wi-Fi, so you need to be within Wi-Fi range.
Well, that's
but
good.
That okay, yeah. So it means that
it's more of a concern for a business than an individual, though.
Certainly you could be targeted. And if you went to Starbucks, there's a lot of – the idea is that any device with this chipset that receives this malformed message will execute code.
So is this chipset in a Wi-Fi access point, or is it – it's in computers, right? This is a
– both.
It's both.
It's everywhere. It's a widely used – it's MIMO – it's Bluetooth. It's a super popular chip because these guys did a beautiful job, except there's a little bug in their firmware of the chip. So one of these bugs is specific to this particular 88W8897 Wi-Fi controller. But the other bug may be based on the ThreadX operating system. So now details are being withheld, because he did then inform Embedi informed Marvel May of 2018 that they had found the problem. But again, so here's the problem, is that it could certainly be the case that chips moving forward will have this fixed, but I don't know for sure. I could not get an answer. Everybody is being, tight-lipped about this, because this is really bad. This is in a billions of devices all over the world. And the reason we're not hearing more about it yet is that the proof of concept has not been released. There is a demo of this happening. The guy showed it at a conference in November. There's a demo of it happening online, but no proof of concept required. He says it requires no user interaction. It can be triggered in what happens is every 5 minutes the typical Wi-Fi chip reaches out to enumerate Wi-Fi signals, Wi-Fi base stations, access points, users, whatever, within its range. So at that point, the device could be compromised. It requires no knowledge of the Wi-Fi network name or passphrase or key. You need to know nothing about it, because it's such a low level. It's down at the low level, the Etherlink protocol level of the chip, and gives the attacker arbitrary code execution on this Wi-Fi SoC, this system on a chip.
This is in the Surface computers.
It is in the Microsoft Surface machines.
Oh, boy.
And so here's the problem, is it's not clear this can be fixed. I don't know one way or the other. I've got a link in the show notes to the demonstration proof of concept video.
It's in my Xbox One.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The J1 smartphones, fortunately, the Galaxy J1s aren't super popular, but Samsung Chromebooks are, Surfaces are, Xbox Ones and PlayStation 4s are. Holy cow. Yikes.
So I have a feeling we will be following this story for the balance of the year. The problem is that there's enough information that is already disclosed that it's probably possible for bad guys to independently follow in the footsteps of Embedi and reconstruct this. And they're you know, once they do release something, once Marvel has some sort of response to this, these guys have said they're going to release a proof of concept and the details of their tools. But the problem is, we know billions of devices are not going to get their firmware updated. So, and this is just so juicy. The idea of a no click, no authentication, over the air. You don't have to physically touch a device. You just have to, you know, zap it with the proper packet when it reaches out, and you can take it over. It's going to be just for like the real hackers. It's going to be, they're not going to be able to control themselves. We will see exploits for this.
So I could go and sit in a coffee shop. Now, nobody, of course, the code's not out there, but when you say owned, what could I just start capturing all the packets coming out of that device, for instance?
Yes, for instance, exactly.
Okay.
And you could also turn around and then access the system that Wi-Fi chip is sitting on, because the chip itself is on the bus. So you could then access probably main memory of that chip and, ooh, you know, rifle around and get private keys and so forth, because we don't want anybody in our main memory.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah, because the way the architectures are now, the bandwidth of these chips is so high that they have direct DMA access into main memory. That is, when they're receiving data, there it is being streamed directly into the main memory of the system, which means that the chip itself has access.
Man.
Yeah.
Yikes. So that's worse than capturing your packets. That's seeing everything that's going on.
Yeah. They can rummage around. Wow. I have a feeling this is going to be a field day for the bad guys. And in a lot of machines that, as you said, that people have, you have a bunch of them already.
I do. I have all of them. Oh boy.
Okay, Leo, get this. Pwn to Own adds a Tesla Model 3.
Oh crap. Please don't pwn my Tesla.
No, that's good news, because you want these guys to find and fix the bugs. And in fact, if they do, $900,000 worth of prizes for the Tesla. So there's money in them thar hacks. So this is this will be at March's forthcoming. I think it's March 20 to the 22nd, forthcoming. The CanSec West in Vancouver, which we talk about every year because it's so much fun. It will, for the first time, add automobiles to its hacking target. So the biggest prizes will be $250,000. For hacks that execute code on the Tesla Model 3's three primary systems. There's something that's generically known as the gateway. There's the autopilot and the VCSEC. The gateway is the central hub that interconnects, as it sounds, like as you'd expect, the car's powertrain, the chassis, and other components, and processes the data that they are exchanging. The autopilot, of course, is the driver assistance feature that helps control lane changing, parking, and other functions. This VCSEC is the vehicle controller secondary. That's the term used. It's responsible for security functions, including the car's alarm. These three systems represent the most critical parts of a Tesla, so it's clear why hacks successfully targeting them would be eligible for big payouts. To qualify, the exploits must force the gateway, autopilot, or this VSEC to communicate with a rogue base station or other malicious entity. Stepping down from that, a denial of service attack, which could take out, for example, the car's autopilot, will pay $50,000. So they want to know if you can do that, but that's a step down from, you know, forcing one of those three critical systems to to have a communication with a malicious external entity. Also, Pwn to Own will pay $100,000 for hacks that attack the Tesla's key fob or phone as key, either by achieving code execution, unlocking the vehicle, or starting the engine without the key. It'll pay a $100,000 add-on prize for winning hacks in another category that attack the car's controller area network. We've talked about this in the past, the so-called CAN bus, which is the bus that interconnects literally everything. You know, it's no longer the case that there's a big wiring harness like you and I used to have in the first cars that we owned, where you could, like, you know, peel back the floorboard mat and you'd see this huge bundle of wires going to, like, the tail lights and the brake lights and the backup lights and the turn signals and everything. That's all gone. Now everything just gets power and a signal, and all of the, you know, light on, light off stuff is multiplexed over this CAN bus. So targets or hacks targeting the car's infotainment system is also on the menu, which will earn a successful exploiter $35,000. And hacks which escape the security sandbox or escalate privileges to root or access the car's OS kernel will fetch $85,000. Wi-Fi or Bluetooth hacks get $60,000. And there's a separate add-on payment of $50,000, which will be paid for winning hacks that achieve persistence, which means, of course, that once they get in, they set up shop in your car and survive a reboot of the system. So anyway, at the end of the month, let's see, the Tuesday following, it happens to be my birthday, March 26th. So as I turn 64, we're going to find out about how the Tesla Model 3 withstood the CanSec West Pwn to Own. And of course, there's always, as always, there are the attacks against things without wheels. We have a $250,000 for a success. Boy, these contests
are business. You got to get in this business, Steve. There's some money in there.
You're making some money. $250,000 for a successful Hyper-V client to a client guest to host escalation, and respectively $150,000, $70,000, and $35,000 for hacks of VMware's ESXi, VMware Workstation, and Oracle VirtualBox, respectively. So stepping down. The web browser attack category will pay $80,000 for hacks of Chrome and Microsoft Edge. And in the case of Edge, with a Windows Defender application guard specific escape. So you got to get out in order to do something. And a Firefox exploit will net $40,000. And the coverage of this, Trend Micro puts this on. The server side category is much smaller this year with Microsoft Windows Remote Desktop Protocol, the RDP, as the only target. And Trend Micro noted that most of their server-side targets had moved to their targeted incentive program, so they're no longer needed to be in Pwn to Own. They've sort of changed where that's being done. But still, a successful exploit of Remote Desktop Protocol will bag its user or its exploiter $150,000. Of course, that's significant because we have been talking about cross-internet RDP exploits, which it's surprising to me how many people have Remote Desktop protocol exposed, and it's just not secure enough to let people get to it. So at the end of March, we'll have some news about how all that's going. Russia is not doing so well with blocking internet services they dislike. As we discussed at the time, back in April, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, the Russian agency responsible for censoring Russian citizen access to the internet, and I can't pronounce this, Roskomnadzor.
Exactly right.
Thank you, Leo.
Perfect.
They attempted to block, as we know, Telegram after Telegram ignored their threats of blocking the service. We'll recall that after that initial block, Telegram moved their servers into the cloud network space where, you know, being served by Amazon and Google, which resulted in Russia blocking wide swaths of IPs, which blocked many more critical services than just Telegram. So it turns out it's easier said than done to block a service. And of course, for their part, Telegram users evaded the blocking by using VPNs and various available proxy services, after which Russia again countered by expanding its block list and ended up blocking even more. So now, and Reuters later reported in August of 2018 that Russia then started testing, you know, and kind of went off of the news map, quote, more precise technology to block individual online services, though really it didn't make much news after that. So, and way back before that, back in 2016, Russia had also attempted to block LinkedIn with limited success. So, you know, they want control over what happens in their country. And the problem is, as I said, it's easier said than done. So we're talking about this now because Russia has now set their sights on Facebook and Twitter.
Oh, boy.
I know. Exactly. Good luck. Roskomnadzor.
If you say it like that, it just rolls off the tongue. Roskomnadzor.
Much better, Leo. Last December 17th, that agency, who you just mentioned convincingly, sent letters to both Facebook and Twitter accusing them of failing to comply, as indeed they were, with a law requiring all servers that store personal data to be stored in Russia. They just said, No. The letters gave each company 30 days to provide a, quote, a legally valid response, unquote. Well, that time has passed. That was up last week, and neither company even bothered to reply. So the Wall Street Journal now reports that today that agency begins administrative proceedings against both companies. The Russian censorship agency said the social media networks hadn't submitted any formal and specific plans or submitted an acceptable explanation of when they would meet the country's requirements that all servers used to store Russians' personal data. I mean, come on, give me a break. All right, for Russian privacy sake, to store Russians' personal data be located in Russia. Russia has previously threatened to block Facebook over its ongoing non-compliance with this data storage law in 2017 and in 2018. So this is not new. Anyway, this should provide some interesting fodder for the podcast because as we have, I mean, in the case of Telegram, you would think that would be more easy. And, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised to learn that these large global mega services had deliberately adopted network architectures.
Oh, yeah. They're multi-homed. They're all over. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That made blocking them extremely difficult.
Roskomnadzor is the FCC of Russia, and they call it RKN. If you just want to make it simple for
yourself. Roskomnadzor. Now, see, now that you said
Nadzor,
it right,
yeah.
I can see it.
Yeah, it's easy. Everybody knows Roskomnadzor.
Roskomnadzor.
Soviet Union, yeah. Roskomnadzor calls you.
You taught me how to pronounce Huawei, Leo, and I held on to that.
I have no idea if I'm saying it right. I'm just spelling it out. But RKN is allowed.
Okay, good. Okay. And so is our second break. And then we're going to talk about Anubis, this very annoying banking malware that is bothering Android users.
До свидания, товарищ. Роскомнадзор. Надзор. I'm sure some Russians are sitting there going, oh, you guys. Our show today brought to you by Wasabi.
Okay, I almost spit out my coffee there.
Sorry, I had to do it. Wasabi, it's hot cloud storage. From my friends who made Carbonite, put the Carbonite on the back, David Friend, literally my friend, David Friend, and his buddy Jeff Flowers, they created Wasabi. Actually, really it goes back to Carbonite days where they invented a patented way to write to hard drives sequentially, directly, which turns out to be faster and more efficient. And that's what put Carbonite on the map. Now they're doing it with Hot Cloud Storage, a brand new company for David and Jeff. And this is really exciting because using this technique, they can give you 11 nines of durability. That's as good as it gets, 11 nines. No, nobody goes past that. 6 times faster than S3 at a fifth of the price. So, I mean, come on. Why wouldn't you want that? 80% less than Amazon's S3. By the way, you get unlimited free egress. So they don't charge you for egress. There's no charge for API calls. It runs super fast, both uploads and downloads. The data, and since you don't pay for egress, that's nice, right? Their data centers are redundant, of course. It's multi-home. They've got 11 nines data durability. Oh, they've also added something I really like, and anybody listening to this show should understand and appreciate. They call it immutable storage. This is storage that cannot be modified. So, and if you think about your cloud storage, there's definitely files you don't want touched. You don't want them encrypted by malware. You don't want them deleted by accident. Immutable storage protects you against accidental or malicious deletions or modifications. Enterprise-grade security. It's HIPAA, FINRA, CJIS compliant. That means fully encrypted. It's easy to use. The client's simple and free. Drag and drop transfers. It uses the S3 API, so you already know how to talk to it, and so does your software. You get active integrity checking. I really like this. This goes along with the immutable storage. Sometimes you do want files to be modified. Active integrity checking makes sure that all the objects that are stored are checked, verified for their integrity every 90 days. You don't get one stray bit out of place. This is a highly secure, disruptive technology that is already turning the industry on its ears. I know when you're thinking cloud, and a lot of people use multiple clouds, you got the big three in there. You got AWS, you got Google, you got Microsoft. I just want you to add a fourth to that list of stuff you're considering. And when you bring the boss, the numbers for Wasabi, 80% cheaper, 6 times faster, I think you're going to look pretty good. Experience Wasabi for yourself right now. You get free unlimited storage. This is a deal just for Security Now listeners. When you go to wasabi.com, W-A-S-A-B-I, yeah, that kind of wasabi, wasabi.com, it's a pun. See, hot cloud storage. Get it hot. Go to wasabi.com. You click the free trial link, but do enter the code Security Now in the offer code because that'll give you, instead of a terabyte, unlimited free storage for a month just so you can test it out. That's all I ask. Add this to your list of hot cloud storage providers you're looking at. When you see the benefits, you see the price, it's a real winner. Wasabi. Wasabi.com. Click the free trial link and use the code Security Now. Wasabi. Now we go back to Steve Razkodnadzov.
I'm going to name a podcast, one of our episodes. Roskomnadzor.
And then you'll have to say it.
Mark my words. when we have our big story about the failure of Russian censorship, Roskomnadzor, we will proudly.
It's funny because we think of the Great Firewall of China. I mean, China blocks Twitter and Facebook. You figure, well, it must be doable, but of course, that requires a country where the entire internet access goes through the government.
Yeah.
And Russia's not, I guess, in that position yet. I say yet.
Yeah. Well, and the fact is, the internet was designed to resist this.
Yes.
I mean, it was like it
routes around damage. That's considered damage, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, speaking of damage, Anubis is the banking malware you really don't want in your Android smartphone if you do any online banking with your smartphone, which really, you know.
Who doesn't?
I would. Yeah. Okay. So get this. Trend Micro found two instances of this Anubis malware using what they called motion-based evasion tactics. So first of all, this Anubis Trojan has been observed. I mean, it is very competent. It has been observed to attack 377 different bank applications from 93 countries around the world.
Wow.
Aimed at a bank I've never heard of, Santander.
Santander is that's a big bank.
Okay, Santander, yeah. RBS, NatWest, Citibank, as well as non-banking apps such as Amazon, eBay, and PayPal, among obviously many others. So it is an aggressive and capable banking malware Trojan. Trend, as I mentioned, recently discovered it hiding inside two Android Google Play store apps, which each had dozens of fake 5-star ratings and thousands of installations into Android devices. So this thing had gotten into people's. So the two apps are Currency Converter, Currency Converter, and Battery Saver Mobi. So again, you know,
don't install those two.
Be a little skeptical. Yeah. Yes. What sets these apart from other malware-carrying Android apps is their use of their host's motion sensors to detect whether they've been installed in a malware analysis sandbox, in which case their malicious behavior is suppressed.
Wow.
They behave themselves. Oh. Isn't that clever?
So if it's in a sandbox, it doesn't get carried around. It's not like a real phone, right?
Exactly. And you don't have some random motion sensor sending data, you know, accelerometer data into the OS. So that'll just be sitting there doing nothing. Now, again, this is all a cat and mouse game, because now that the sandbox guys know this is a possibility, it's like, we'll add emulation of motion to the motion sensing the sandbox to trigger motion sensitive awareness in malware and be able to catch this happening. But again, this is why, you know, it's just like this back and forth game. Creating a secure system, which, you know, we keep seeing that creating a secure system, which is also powerful and flexible, is something which has so far eluded the best brains in computer science, because you could argue there's like, you know, this is an important thing and we haven't figured out how to do it yet. You know, we know that we could have a system which is closed and secure, like the original Apple iPhone. But people want apps. You know, we want open stuff. I certainly do. And we want capable apps. But so far, with app capability comes app liability and exploitability. And despite all of our best efforts, we haven't yet figured out how to get the one that we want, which is capability, without inviting the others we don't want. You know, and then there's social engineering. I put on the previous page of the show notes, Leo, this is a dialogue that this Anubis app presents, because it
would
needs
fool me.
Yes, it would fool
me.
Anybody.
It's the system update dialogue, which you see all the time on Android.
Exactly. And when you click it, you're giving the Anubis malware admin permissions on your system. So, I mean, the very fact that that is possible demonstrates that we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Because who would not click that? It'd be like,
Now, anybody. How do you have to download one of these apps onto your phone From the Play Store? No, they're not in the Play Store.
Yes, they're in the Google Play Store.
Not anymore, they're not. They can't.
Well, no, they've been yanked, but but thousands of people did download them from the Google Play Store where they were with fake five-star ratings.
So, and they do have to ask permission, so they pop this up.
Yes.
And then I presume you get a legit permissions dialogue, but you assume it has to do with the system update. So you say,
yeah,
okay.
I mean, who knows? Yeah. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so the problem is, of course, social engineering. You know, we're going to click on that, and that's going to give this thing rights. So we have a ways to go before we figure out, you know, how to do this stuff in a secure fashion.
Yeah.
To that end, Google is cracking down on Android phone and SMS using apps, that is apps that ask for phone and SMS permissions. Last Monday, Paul Bankhead, who's the director of product management for Google Play, posted to the Android developers blog. So this is written, as we'll hear, to developers. But I wanted to share this with our listeners because I'm glad Google is like taking these steps. It's going to cause problems, but unfortunately, we've been too permissive in the past. So his first little paragraph, TLDR, says, as previously announced and directly communicated to developers via email, in other words, you know, don't blame us, we warned you, we'll be removing apps from the Google Play Store that ask for SMS or call log permission and have not submitted a permissions declaration form. Mm. If you have not submitted a permissions declaration form and your app is removed, see below for next steps. And then he explains, he says, we take access to sensitive data and permissions very seriously. Well, yeah, they do now, or increasingly do. He says, this is especially true with SMS and call log permissions, which were designed to allow users to pick their favorite dialer or messaging app, but have also been used to enable many other experiences, experiences that might not require that same level of access. In an effort to improve users' control over their data, last October, we announced we would be restricting developer access to SMS and call log permissions. Our new policy is designed to ensure that apps asking for these permissions need full and ongoing access to the sensitive data in order to accomplish the app's primary use case, and that users will understand why this data would be required for the app to function. And of course, we've also often talked about the overbroad, like, you know, you install an app and it needs like access to all kinds of stuff that seem completely, you know, tangential to the app's intention or purpose, or like, why would it need that? So he says, developers whose apps used these permissions prior to our announcement were notified by email and given 90 days to either remove the permissions or submit a permissions declaration form to enable further review. And he says, we take this review process seriously and understand it's a change for many developers. We apply the same criteria to all developers, so, you know, they're not taking sides, including dozens of Google apps. We added to the list of approved use cases over the last few months as we evaluated feedback from developers. So in other words, they allowed developers to explain why they needed access to this, even though you wouldn't at first blush maybe have thought so. He says, our global teams carefully review each submission. During the review process, we consider the following. 5 points. First, likelihood that an average user would understand why this type of app needs full access to the data. Second, user benefit of the feature. Third, that's really good. I mean, I hope Google's really, I mean, it sounds like they're really going to honor this, and they should. The user benefit of the feature. Third, the importance of the permission relative to the core functionality of the app. 4, risks presented by all apps with this use case having access to this sensitive data, meaning, if everybody asks for this, what does that mean? And then 5, availability of more narrow alternatives for enabling this feature. In other words, isn't there a better way to achieve the same thing that doesn't require giving this permission? So this is all for the best. This is great. They said, with this change, some use cases will no longer be allowed. However, many of the apps we reviewed with one of these permissions can rely on narrower APIs. In other words, they were just, the developer was kind of lazy and said, yeah, just give me all this. Reducing the scope of access while accomplishing similar functionality. For example, he writes, developers using SMS for account verification can alternatively use the SMS Retriever API, and apps that want to share content using SMS can pre-populate a message and trigger the default SMS app to show via intents. In other words, that's a perfect example of using, instead of just getting global access to SMS, use a specific narrow API designed to do just and only that aspect, the SMS account verification through this SMS Retriever API. He says, tens of thousands of developers have already resubmitted their apps to support the new policy or have submitted a form. Thank you. Developers who submitted a form received a compliance extension until March 9th. And he goes on about next steps. But anyway, I just think this is great. I mean, this feels like, lessons learned from the road and from the real world. And it's always painful to take things away which had previously been given. But Google is learning through interaction with, their platform out in the world that, we need to take this more seriously. There are all kinds of clever ways we hadn't thought of for the things that we were permitting apps to do to abuse those permissions. So we're going to create narrower APIs first, and then we're going to force apps to use those or to explain to us why they can't get by with using those. So, yes, it's what we need. So, props to Google for that. As I mentioned at the top, Leo, you guys started MacBreak Weekly this week talking about Tim Cook's note in Time Magazine. Mm-hmm. You read it into the podcast. I'm going to read it into ours because it's short. And my take is a little different. First of all, I couldn't understand everybody's take on MacBreak because it was such a hot topic. Everyone was talking at once, and
I know.
It was like, whoa, okay, what happened?
Everybody had to get their word in there.
What happened? So last week, Time Magazine printed a statement by Apple's Tim Cook, which took aim at, and this is, I think, the significant part of this. This is not Apple versus Google and Facebook, which is how it's so easy to paint that with a broad brush because that meme has been established. What Apple did, what Tim Cook did, was take aim at what is the largely hidden data brokerage industry, which has quietly sprung up over the past decade. And we've touched on it on this podcast from time to time. Sometimes as I'm doing some research, I'll encounter one of those chilling websites where they tout everything they know about us, because they're trying to sell this intelligence gathering capability to an audience different than ours. And I often will share that on the podcast because it just kind of gives me the creeps. So I think that Tim raises some important points. And as I said, this is not the accepted Apple versus Facebook and Google profit models where Apple is saying, we don't profit from the collection of your data, but they do. And that's not what he wrote. So here's what he said. He said, We all deserve control over our digital lives. That's why we must rein in the data brokers. In 2019, it's time to stand up for the right to privacy. Yours, mine, all of ours. Consumers shouldn't have to tolerate another year of companies irresponsibly amassing huge user profiles, data breaches that seem out of control, and the vanishing ability to control our own digital lives. The problem is solvable. It isn't too big, too challenging, or too late. Innovation, breakthrough ideas, and great features can go hand in hand with user privacy, and they must. Realizing technology's potential depends on it. That's why I and others are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass comprehensive federal privacy legislation, a landmark package of reforms that protect and empower the consumer. Last year, before a global body of privacy regulators, I laid out four principles that I believe should guide legislation. First, the right to have personal data minimized. Companies should challenge themselves to strip identifying information from consumer data or avoid collecting it in the first place. Second, the right to knowledge, to know what data is being collected and why. Third, the right to access. Companies should make it easy for you to access, correct, and delete your personal data. And fourth, the right to data security, without which trust is impossible. He says, but laws alone aren't enough to ensure that individuals can make use of their privacy rights. We also need to give people tools that they can use to take action. To that end, here's an idea that could make a real difference. One of the biggest challenges in protecting privacy is that many of the violations are invisible. For example, you might have bought a product from an online retailer, something most of us have done. But what the retailer doesn't tell you is that it then turned around and sold or transferred information about your purchase to a data broker, a company that exists purely to collect your information, package it, and resell it to yet another buyer. The trail, he writes, disappears before you even know there is a trail. Right now, all of these secondary markets for your information exist in a shadow economy that's largely unchecked, out of sight of consumers, regulators, and lawmakers. He says, and he finishes, let's be clear. You never signed up for that. We think every user should have the chance to say, wait a minute, that's my information you're selling, and I didn't consent. Oh, and he says, meaningful, comprehensive federal privacy legislation should not only aim to put consumers in control of their data, it should also shine a light on actors trafficking in your data behind the scenes. Some state laws are looking to accomplish just that. But right now, there's no federal standard protecting Americans from these practices. That's why we believe the Federal Trade Commission should establish a data broker clearinghouse, requiring all data brokers to register, enabling consumers to track the transactions that have bundled and sold their data from place to place, and giving users the power to delete their data on demand, freely, easily, and online once and for all. And he finishes, as this debate kicks off, there will be plenty of proposals and competing interests for policymakers to consider. We cannot lose sight of the most important constituency, individuals trying to win back their right to privacy. Technology has the potential to keep changing the world for the better, but it will never achieve that potential without the full faith and confidence of the people who use it. So anyway, I just think, yes, he's right that we know that this shadow economy exists. And once again, I find as I read this, I find myself feeling as though we're still in the very early days of this explosion in processing power, the collapse in the cost of mass storage, which has enabled endless compilation of these profiles, and like every scrap and tidbit of data can be sucked in and retained, which you couldn't do if it was like prohibitively expensive to do that. And of course, the connectivity created by the internet. And not surprisingly, the regulatory framework that's needed to govern the implications of these changes lags far behind. And, you know, if any of us who have, and we often have listened to our policymakers talk or listened to congressional testimony and hearings, and the questions that they ask demonstrate that those who would create the regulations barely have any idea how this stuff works. And I don't have any idea how powerful the lobbying clout is of these data brokers, but it might be significant. And unfortunately, as we know, money drives a lot of this country's politics. So was there any sort of a conclusion from the discussion that you guys had, Leo, in Mac Break?
Well, conclusion, like, is this a good idea? I think everybody thinks it's a good idea, right?
Is there any chance it could happen?
We didn't actually talk about that. Fear, of course, is so I think you're a trifle, I don't want to say naive, but you're a nice guy in thinking that Tim Cook's just talking about data brokers, because really, he may not say Google and Facebook, but anytime Apple talks about privacy, there is always the subtext of we do it right. Always.
Yes. Well, so, I do agree that this is brilliant marketing.
You're not naive. Great. You understand.
No.
He may not say it explicitly, but it's always about us versus Google and Facebook. It's about data brokers. And the one thing we did point out is that if Apple were really serious about this, they would, for instance, not require everybody to use Google as your search in Safari on the iOS device. But the reason they do it is because Google gives them $9 billion a year. Actually, this year it'll be, according to some estimates, $12 billion to be the search tool. And if you want to protect privacy, you don't give it to Google. And
so I guess that means you use a different browser and use DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, DuckDuckGo has a browser. Apple should, if Apple really cared about this, it seems to me, they would at least give you the option to use DuckDuckGo and Safari, right?
Yep.
They don't, because it's billions of dollars in the pocket. So it's a little, that's a point to be made. Also, as soon as you use an iPhone, the minute you put Facebook on it, forget it. Doesn't matter how secure Apple is. You've got Facebook on there. You're being spied upon immediately. So it's reasonable for Tim to say, we want these regulations because, users are going to put Facebook on our beautiful, pristine, private phones and... and then, it's just as bad as any other phone. Finally, the other thing that we talked about is that one of Apple's big fears, every company's big fear, is not that there'll be federal regulation. Everybody, by the way, including Google and Facebook, are calling for federal regulation. But that the states will – the reason they do that is because the states will individually, as California has, impose own privacy rules. And then you have a crazy quilt of 50 different rules. I mean, you already have to do GDPR. That's the other thing, is that every company that does business in Europe is already doing most of those 4 points because GDPR.
And you probably saw that Google got hit with a massive GDPR fine.
50 million euros, yeah. By the way, for kind of something dumb.
Yeah, I know. It's like, okay. But you're right. We talked about the lack of federal oversight in the case of network neutrality, where, again, having every state have their own legislation, it's just a nightmare for the carriers.
No. And it isn't a nightmare. They know that they don't have to worry about it. And the feds have already said the states can't do it.
Yep.
Marco Rubio from Florida has already proposed in Congress a rule that says states can't make their own privacy regulations. Leave it to the big boys. Leave it to the grown-ups.
That's right. We'll take care of it.
And the presumption is, that is probably the right thing to do, but the presumption is that they will then, by getting all the power in the federal Congress, be able to write their own laws, these data brokers, and they won't have to worry about anybody. So, yeah, well, I don't know if it'll happen. There is definitely a current going in the country that people want this. So maybe it will. It's technically tough.
As long as the head of the Data Brokers Association is not put in charge of drafting the legislation.
Making it rain.
when have we seen that before?
Let me think.
I
think ultimately we're going to have to protect our own privacy, and we're going to use DuckDuckGo, things like that, right?
Exactly. And that's what this podcast is. One of the things this podcast is about.
That's why we're here.
Speaking of which, this brings us to a piece that I only saw from being covered, or actually, I guess it's really not as much news as sort of a public service announcement from Sophos that is a sponsor of. It was a sponsor that appeared last week on this podcast.
Yeah. Huh? Yes, our new sponsor. Yeah.
New sponsor, Sophos. I've got a link in the show notes. They are the source of this bit.ly link I talked about, bit.ly/snfbads, which expands to a link also in the show notes for a page that I don't know. Going in the normal, like in the front door, how easy it is for a Facebook user to find this, but this shows the so-called your ad preferences that you may have never known that you had. I'm not a Facebook user. I do have an account because I needed once upon a time to like look at the privacy and security settings that Facebook was offering. So I logged into that dusty old account in order to bring up two pages that I have here in the show notes. So if you do bit.ly/snfbads, you can learn what Facebook is doing for you. And so there are six main topics: your interests, that is what Facebook has somehow independently determined your interests are, advertisers, your information, your ad settings, which you may not have known, I didn't know that you had, hide ad topics, your ability to hide ad topics, like parents could hide alcohol ads from minors, for example, and then an explanation of how Facebook ads work. And when I saw ad settings, I clicked on that. And so it's got three sub settings. And so for the first one, for example, the first one, which is default allowed, it says ads based on data from partners, which is, exactly what we've been talking about. It says to show you better ads, we use data that advertisers and other partners provide to us about your activity off of Facebook company products. So, and that's allowed, but you can click it and say, no. Then the second one, ads based on activity on Facebook company products that you see elsewhere. And that is explained. When we show you ads off Facebook company products, such as on websites, apps, and devices that use our advertising services, we use data about your activity on Facebook company products to make them more relevant. And that, of course, is also default allowed, and you can say no. And then there was the third is ads that include your social actions. And they explain, we may include your social actions on ads such as liking the page that's running the ad, who can see this info. And then I had this set to no one. I don't know why it's set to no one. Maybe because I don't have any links to something or who knows what. But anyway, there are that's just one of the six things that I opened. I thought it would be of interest to any of our listeners who didn't know that this was there. This is some nice disclosure and some controls, but also for our listeners to forward this to their friends and family that might want to know. in Sophos's coverage of this, they said Fitbit, pollination, jaguars, snakes, mason jars. They said, okay, fine, Facebook. I'm not surprised that I've clicked on those things. In fact, on mine, under, I think it was on advertisers, mine were cars and realtors. And I have no idea why, because, you know, I'm driving a 2011 car and I own my home since 84. Since, you know, nothing, there's no movement.
The wrong guy on
any of those two categories. So it's like, okay. But they were like 12 different ads and they were all realtors or advertise or car sales. So anyway, Sofo says, but when did I ever click on anything related to Star Trek Voyager or cattle? The guy writing this on Sofo says, my this feels weird reaction makes me one of the 51% of Facebook users who report that they're not comfortable that the ad-driven company creates a list that assigns each of us categories based on our real-life interests. Yeah. It's called your ad preferences. And they say you can view yours here. If you drill down, you can see where Facebook gets its categorization ideas from, including the things we click on or like, what our relationship status is, who employs us, and far more. So anyway, just an FYI of some useful information. I thought this was a nice page to know about, and I don't know if you're just looking at your Facebook page, if it's easy to get there from the front page, but it's your ad preferences on Facebook, and some interesting information is there. Okay, one last piece before we take our last break and get into the final bits. Cisco's small business switches have a serious problem. And so anyone using small business switches, pay attention. This is sort of gobsmacking, as they would say in the UK. If you, your organization, or anyone you know are using Cisco 200 or 250 series smart switches, 300 or 350 series managed switches, Cisco 350X, 500 or 500X series stackable managed switches, there's a real problem. And we've talked about this recently, like last year, a number of times. Cisco was apparently auditing their own source and kept finding backdoors that had been written into their source code. I don't know if they were by developers who left this behind or what. In this case, this does not sound like the cause of the problem. This sounds deliberate, but it's a little stunning. In Cisco's summary of this, they said a vulnerability, and that's not what it is, but they said a vulnerability. And I mean, I guess they want it to be in the Cisco small business switches software could allow an unauthenticated, that's also not what it is, but I'll explain in a second, remote attacker to bypass the user authentication mechanism of an affected device. Almost none of that is true, but they go on. The vulnerability exists because under specific circumstances, which are the default circumstances, but anyway, the affected software enables a privileged user account without notifying administrators of the system. An attacker could exploit this vulnerability by using this account to log in to an affected device and execute commands with full admin rights. Sounds bad. Cisco has not released software updates that address this vulnerability. This advisory will be updated with fixed software information once fixed software becomes available. There is a workaround to address this vulnerability. Okay, so what's really going on? Unbelievably, as I said, it's another of those Cisco default built-in passwords. The vulnerability, which has been assigned a CVE last year, it's CVE-2018-15439, which has a critical base CVSS severity rating of, ready, 9.8. So, you know.
Is 10 the highest?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And if it were 9.8 on IMDb, it'd be the most famous and popular movie anyone had ever seen.
Yeah.
So, baby, you know, it's up there. It exists, get this, because the default configuration of these devices, okay, these are highly popular, widely sold, inexpensive Cisco, like, you know, networking gear. The default configuration of these devices includes a privileged user account that is used for the initial login and cannot be removed from the system. An administrator may disable this account by configuring other user accounts with access privilege level set to 15. However, and you don't need to do that in order to use this, so it's often not done. If no user configured privilege level 15 accounts exist in the device configuration, the default privileged user account is enabled without notifying administrators of the system. So there's no notification given that this default login exists. Cisco says, quote, under these circumstances, which is the default the circumstances, an attacker can use this account to log in to an so that's not bypassing authentication, it's logging in, it's using authentication, log in to an affected device and execute commands with full admin rights. It could allow an unauthenticated remote attacker to bypass the user authentication mechanism, to use the user authentication mechanism of an affected device. So anyway, there is no work. The workaround is there is no patch. There's no update. There's nothing. There's no firmware available yet. And unfortunately, as we know, even once it's created, I mean, these are widely used low-end Cisco networking gear that someone finally woke up to having, probably because they realized people were getting in somehow and someone looked to figure out how, and it's like, oops. Unless someone sets an adds an account with privilege level 15, this default account is enabled. So that if any of our listeners know of or are responsible for or knows anybody who is responsible for any of these low-end 200, 250, 300, 350, 500, 550 series switches, you absolutely want to create your own account with privilege level 15 in order to disable the default account. There is no other way to do it on these switches. So, wow, just unbelievable oversight and it feels like the fact that creating one disables it. I mean, maybe there's a disable which is broken, but it feels like this was on purpose, like by design, and they're finally getting around to saying, maybe we shouldn't have done that. So I hope our listeners will protect themselves. Mm. And Leah, let's take our last break. Then we have some miscellany, some errata, and some closing the loop feedback and a discussion of the one and only VPN client anyone needs for Android.
I'm dying to know the that one. That'll be interesting. All right. I should mention, by the way, that Newark is now reopened, but it was closed for some time, starting at about half an hour ago, due to two drones sighted at Teeter Bay, 14 miles away. Flights going into Newark from other cities are still being held up, but flights have started taking off again from Newark.
Wow.
So, yeah, this is the new normal.
This drone problem.
It's, yeah, interesting, isn't it? Our show today brought to you by WordPress. Oh, I love my WordPress. I love me some WordPress. Steve uses WordPress for his personal blog. I use it, leolaporte.com. That's my own one and only WordPress blog, and I've been a WordPress.com user for 12 years. WordPress is so dominant in the web. It is so big that 33% of the internet runs on WordPress. A third, there's nothing even close. A third of the whole internet runs on WordPress software, whether it's self-hosted or WordPress.com. Now, I got to tell you, I did run a self-hosted WordPress blog for a while. You got to find a server, you got to pay for it, you got to install the software, you got to keep it running, you got to make sure. And by the time you're done, you have very little time to blog. So that's why I moved to WordPress.com. Let them host it, let them run it, let them keep it secure and updated. You choose from thousands of themes. There's 24-hour support 7 days a week from real experts. They've got great site-building tools. Whether it's a personal site or a business site, WordPress.com is simply the best. No two-week trials. No hidden fees. You own your content. You own your account. You can upload anything, audio, video, text, pictures. Store it on WordPress. Anytime you want it, you can download it directly. And their free tier means it's free to start and there's room to grow. I actually have a business account because I want all the business features. You might too. They even have e-commerce on there. Their customer support team is great, friendly, but they're WordPress experts. They start as WordPress experts and then WordPress hires them. So, you know, you're not getting somebody who's reading from a notebook. You're getting somebody who really knows the software deeply. WordPress platform is so powerful, so flexible. Some of the biggest companies on earth use it to build their websites, whether it's commerce or news. Lots of news organizations, including Fortune, Quartz, run on WordPress. Millions of people use WordPress.com every day to turn their dreams into reality. You should, too. So if you're thinking about making a website, but you don't want all the trouble, or you have a website and it's just not living up to its promise, you got to check it out. WordPress.com/security now. There is an advantage to doing it right now. You get 15% off any new plan purchase, but only if you go to WordPress.com/security now. That way Steve gets credit. WordPress.com/security now. Simply the best place to start your new website. And, you know, by the way, there's an advantage to being on the platform everybody uses. There's so many great tools and templates and information. You know, it's just fantastic. WordPress.com/security now. We thank them so much for their support of the podcast. And now Steve Gibson.
So a couple little bits of miscellany. I wanted to let our listeners know, I was looking around for a file sync solution. I'm now routinely working from two different locations, and since that I hadn't traditionally been doing that, I was initially shuttling, you know, like emailing my development directory to myself in each direction. And the other day I sent the wrong directory. So when I got to my other end, it was like, oh, I don't have all my latest work. So I decided that's crazy. I need to be able to keep directories in sync between different machines. And so I did a little bit looking around, and I think I've settled on a cross-platform solution that fits me, because I mean Google kind of offers this kind of facility, Dropbox does. You know, in my case, I have a server that could be a central location for synchronization that both of the endpoints are able to access. Anyway, Sync Thing looks like a nice solution for this. So I just sort of wanted to put it our listeners' radar. I have not started to play with it yet.
I've used it for a long time. It's fantastic.
Thank you. For
highly
that.
Recommend it.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's free.
Okay. Yes. Yes,
it's open source. It's great.
It felt right. If yeah. I you know they have a donation link at the bottom.
You know,
I'm going to make sure that I use it, and
it's
then
kind of like the old BitTorrent sync that we liked so much.
Similar yes.
idea. You have each place has a code, like each source has a code. You could share that code with people. I really like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Good sync yeah. thing.
Sync.
So I you know as a result of my digging around. That's where I settled on. So I just wanted to say that I haven't started to use it yet, but I will provide a report to our listeners once I have. And I'm glad for the early heads up.
Yeah.
I'm giving a presentation on Squirrel this coming Sunday to a really neat ethical hackers group. And normally they would welcome more of our listeners who are in the area. So I would talk about it. But many are already listeners. And the interest expressed so far by those wishing to attend is already at 180% of the venue's capacity. So I'm going to wait until next week to talk about it anymore, although it will be recorded. We'll have a video made from it, so I'll be able to share that link once it's ready. And apparently, based on the postings to the meeting sign-up board, I'll be signing many copies of SpinRite while I'm there. I guess these are old-timers, and maybe they have like discs and you know of SpinRite, because certainly we used to produce those in the old days. Or maybe they'll have me sign their, I don't know, their thumb drive where they've downloaded SpinRite.
I like it.
But a whole bunch of people said, oh, I finally get my copy of SpinRite signed. Steve's going to be there. It's like, yeah. And so in order to prepare, I've been updating the presentation slides. In fact, that's one of the things that I had missed sent myself the other day. I've been updating the presentation slides that I first created for the DigiCert Security Summit when I did the presentation of Squirrel Den. Then I updated them to demonstrate when I demonstrated Squirrel to Stina and her technical colleagues at Yubico. The latest slides now add the news of this Squirrel Service Provider API that I mentioned last week, and I've talked about it a little bit, but I am increasingly excited about it as I understand how much it will mean for Squirrel. I had never really thought about the server-side implementation until I considered what someone who didn't know Squirrel at all would need to know. I mean, it's true, as I've mentioned before, that there's only one cryptographic function that the server needs, and that's to verify a signature. But there are a lot of other subtleties associated with, like, rekeying a Squirrel identity, allowing a user to disable their use of Squirrel, and a bunch of other stuff. And while it's not rocket science, it's completely unfamiliar to anybody who doesn't know the Squirrel protocol. And so asking a whole bunch of different, I mean, it was foreseeable that there would be server-side implementations created. I had just ended up doing it. And in the process, defining a very simple API that abstracts all of that stuff into, you know, on the other side of the API, making it very simple for someone to add Squirrel to an existing web server. And in fact, this developer I mentioned before in Denmark, who knows the Zen Forum software we're using, was able to quickly and easily add Squirrel support using the API. And now he's working on finishing up the configuration dialogues and adding some touches to the UI. And one of the guys in the GRC news groups who already knows the Squirrel protocol inside and out has received from me my assembly language source code for the API, and he's re-implementing it in portable open source C. So That'll give us a multi-platform, compile it on any platform you want, encapsulated Squirrel API, making it probably a day or two worth of work on any programmer's part to add Squirrel to an existing web server. And I'm excited about that because, as we know, it's one thing to like all the things that Squirrel does, but for it to actually go anywhere, it needs to get adopted. And so this will, I didn't even foresee the need for this server, the service provider API in the beginning until it came time for me to have a website that wasn't natively supporting Squirrel, meaning these Squirrel forums support Squirrel. And then it was like, oh, okay, how should I do that? And we ended up with another really, what's going to end up being a super useful component of this Squirrel ecosystem. So I'm jazzed about that, and I'll be talking about that and more at this conference on Sunday, and then at this hacker meeting on Sunday, and I'll talk about a little bit how it goes next Tuesday. Okay, so errata. As I said, I could not believe what I said last week. This was relating to the expiration of certificates on web servers. When I talked about pushing past the certificate is expired notice, I said that what this meant was that all of the communications would then be in the clear, which is, of course, not the case. It means you say to your browser, yes, I understand the certificate is expired, but let's use it anyway. And in which case,
still encrypted, yes, but it's just expired.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And the problem is I was wrong. So, okay, let's fix that. So, yes, it's still encrypted. It does mean that you have blown your security guarantee that you are subject to man-in-the-middle attacks. A man-in-the-middle could cause that warning to occur, and you say, okay, I don't care, blah, blah, blah. Okay, but still, there was some of the coverage of this was talking about logon credentials being now sent in the clear, and I did not drill down far enough. I just repeated it without thinking. So my apologies for what I know is not the case. We've talked about this so many times before, and a bunch of people wrote to me saying, what?
Oh, like, they, yes. Come on. That's just a...
Anyway, Joe, I needed to fix
get
that.
Get it right.
So,
okay, that's
yes.
Fair.
Yep. So it's right. So it is the case that you are bypassing security, but it is not the case that someone doing passive sniffing, as I said, is then going to be able to see your username and password in the clear. Gary Ford in England said the subject line was 30 gig, and he said, "Dear Steve," this is also errata. He said, "Love the show and SpinRite, but last week 697, you mentioned again as before in 696 about filemail.com, and that you have a 30 gig upstream connection. Really?" He says, bloody hell, he says in English accent. He says, "I get along with 6 megabits downstream and 1 megabit upstream. Some people have 100 megabits DS downstream, which is good. I think I've heard Leo brag of his business connection being 10 gig, but you say 30 gig upstream? He says, I don't know how much SpinRite you sell, but it ain't that big that you need 30 gig up. He says, you're a nice guy and deserve it, but maybe you mean 30 megabits. That would still be impressive. You've said it twice now, and it's bugging me. Have a nice day." And yes, I will now be very self-conscious about 30 megabits, not gigabits. I do not need, I do not want. I can't imagine 30 gig upstream. So, yes, I have always been meaning to say 30 megabits. If I make a mistake again, just correct it, everybody, in your head. Meg, not gig. So, Gary, thank you. Ben,
I just assumed you did have 30 gigs.
No.
Shows
no.
what I know. I just thought, 30. Well, he goes through level three. Maybe they, gave him a big fat glass pipe.
Yeah. No, this is at home. This is like, you know, file mail when it was 30 megabits.
Yeah.
It was 33 megabits that it was saturated. And I could see how I could have said gigabits because it's easy to make that mistake. So, yes, 33 megabits up and 300 megabits down. But rarely do I see that. It's only, you know, sometimes I see I'm downloading something from someone big with a really good CDN or something. And it's like, whoa, I actually do get 300. But mostly, they're feeding it slower than that at the feeding end. And so I don't really ever see that.
Even I think at 100, you're faster than most people are sending.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Ben asks about having a dedicated SpinRite machine. What? W-A-T? And he said, hello, Steve. Longtime listener of Security Now and all Gibson goodness wherever it's available. Crawler of GRC.com, owner of SpinRite, and recommend it to everyone on the train. Mm-hmm. Thank you for all of those. He says, I came across an interesting use case and wondered how to best do it. A friend of mine works at a Photoshop, and he has that in quotes. He says, that's what they're called here. They do a variety of photo services as well as a few other digital services. One of them is restoration, restoring deleted content and or corrupted media. I visited him at his workplace and saw that they're using Recuva, R-E-C-U-V-A.
Recuva, yeah.
Recover. Knowing what the answers will be, I asked him what the success rate is. Expectedly, it's so-so. They use several other such utilities with about the same results. I recommended they buy SpinRite. My friend trusts me, and he convinced the boss to buy it. Success rates are, unsurprisingly, far better now. This got me thinking. They could use a dedicated machine for SpinRite. Since SpinRite consumes the whole machine, and they do this often enough, then a machine dedicated for SpinRite makes sense. So, what hardware would this machine feature? From my own experience with SpinRite, I know that it can become very CPU intensive, depending on what it's dealing with on the target media. So, CPU, lots of power, cores versus clock speed? What else? Machine will, of course, be diskless for itself. Is there anything to avoid? He says, while in normal circumstances, the machine's hardware wouldn't be a big focus. You start SpinRite, let it run. Here, it's different. The machine cannot do anything else. And SpinRite does one thing at a time. So giving it the resources to complete its work quicker is the whole point. I recall that you did say that one can try running SpinRite in a VM and connecting the media to the VM, but you also said that narrows down SpinRite's range of functionality. So what's optimal for SpinRite? If SpinRite can consume the universe, what would it consume? If one had no other considerations, what would that machine look like? I'd love it if you can bring this up in an SN episode. Would also like to thank Leo and the heroic team at Twit as well. Special thanks to Elaine. Her transcripts come in very handy. So Ben, and to all of our listeners, first of all, a dedicated SpinRite machine is a very popular thing. I mean, I've been hearing about them for 30 years. Many people do it. The good news is you actually can use an old piece of junk hardware that is barely useful any longer for anything else. It turns out that it's actually not at all CPU intensive. It is throughput intensive. It is intensive of the connection between the drive and the computer, which is why, if at all possible, for example, you want to mount the drive directly to the interface on the motherboard, not, for example, run it through a USB connection, which can be a bottleneck. So So connecting the drive to the motherboard is really the only thing you need to do. At that point, anything that has the proper connection, old school IDE interface or a SATA interface, which is typical now, that'll do it. But I mean, really, it could be a machine that you've, you know, you stopped using because it wasn't fast enough for any, like, to even run a GUI or any kind of a desktop OS. SpinRite needs no RAM, like literally 640K it runs in. The 6.1 will start using more RAM, but even then, less than a gig. I think it was it was a 30 megabyte buffer because I'm allocating a 64K sector buffer, and a sector is half a K. So it was a 32 megabyte buffer that the next version will use in order to suck in 32 meg at a crack, which is where SpinRite 6.1 will get its huge speed boost. But until then, any hardware you've got, you can use. And so, you know, what it means is also if you had a couple of older machines, you could have several running on different drives at the same time. But anyway, SpinRite is very, very non-critical about the hardware it uses because it's just running DOS, you know, on the chip itself. And so it doesn't actually need much processing power. Steve Fossmeyer in Denton, Texas, asked about Java Update offering to remove itself. And so I'll share his note. He said, I just got a Java Update notification that popped up. So I clicked on Update. And at that point, you know, as all of our listeners used to refer to it, I haven't heard the term for a while, but we called this a Gibsonian response. It was like, whoa, stop everything. A Java Update notification popped up. At that point, you know, if you've been listening to the SpinRite or to the Security Now podcast for long, you're thinking, whoop, what? Wait a minute. So anyway, he goes on. Please remove unused versions of Java. He says, and he says the update read, it appears that you have not used Java on your system in over 6 months. We recommend that you uninstall it by clicking the remove button below. If you later decide you need Java, you can reinstall it from java.com. Okay, now that kind of sounds better. He says, if you wish to keep Java on your system, please update it by clicking the update button below. He says, how about that? I don't remember what thing I needed Java for, but to have it tell me go ahead and remove it is a new thing entirely. Thought you would want to know. I did take a screenshot of the Java update window, so if you decide you want to put this on the SN show, I could send it to you. Thanks for over a decade's worth of free security knowledge. Goodness, Steve. He says, P.S., proud SpinRite site license, he says in parens, four, meaning four copies, owner from my previous IT consultant company. He says, closed up shop a year ago and went to work full-time as a network admin at my biggest client. So, okay, this is interesting. So this was not – so I don't know what triggered the update. That would be interesting. But it is if this is legitimate, if Java noted – that it had not been used and suggested it remove itself or you remove it, that's very cool. I agree, Steve. So I think maybe I misunderstood initially what you said. But again, I know that our listeners know that anything that pops up and asks you to take action, depending upon where you are, what you're doing, are you on a website or like what's going on, you know, just – be very skeptical. So I wanted to share that had apparently been possible to have happen. Okay, topic of our show, which mobile VPN client? As I mentioned at the top, Bleeping Computer provided some coverage from a Simon Migliano of Metric, who is the head of research at Metric Labs. In Bleeping Computers coverage, they said one in five apps, okay, one in five from the top 150 free VPN Android apps in Google's Play Store was flagged as a potential source of malware, while a quarter of them, so one in four, come with user privacy breaking bugs such as DNS leaks, which expose users' DNS queries to their ISPs. They wrote, as found by Simon Migliano, Metric Labs' head of research, the company behind the top 10 VPN service, these VPN Android applications have already been installed in approximately 260 million times, or in 260 million phones, according to the numbers reported by Google's official store. Okay, so we got several problems here. First of all, the fact that there are 150 free VPN Android apps, that suggests this is a popular thing, that running a VPN in your Android device is something people want to do. In the show notes, I took a snapshot from Bleeping Computers page where it shows an app by installation. And so, for example, Hotspot Shield free version, more than 50 million downloads, risky permissions were detected, no DNS leaks, risky functions were detected, no virus or malware. SuperVPN, also 150 million downloads, also risky permissions detected, also risky functions detected, and DNS leaks in this one. HiVPN, 10 million downloads, risky permissions detected, risky functions detected, DNS leaks detected, and so on and so on. Going down the list, lots of risky permissions detected, lots of risky functions detected, most of them, all but one of, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So this is the top 10 VPN clients, and of those, 1, 2, 3, 4 did not leak DNS. The other six did. Eight of the 10 had risky functions detected, and a different eight of the 10 had risky permissions detected. Bleeping Computer reported that the research team found the following intrusive permissions and user privacy breaking code. So when I talked about risky functions or risky permissions, get this: location tracking in a quarter of the VPN apps are doing location tracking. Access to device status information in 38% of them. In a fewer number, use of camera and microphone and the ability to secretly send SMS messages in a VPN client, which makes my head explode. Over half, 57%, featured code to get a user's last known location. So this brings us to the main topic and title of today's podcast: which mobile VPN client? There is only one anyone ever needs. It's called, not surprisingly, OpenVPN for Android. I have a link in the show notes. OpenVPN. It's maintained, compiled from OpenVPN source by Arnie Schwab, who's a who lives in Germany, and it's like, maybe it's not flashy. I don't get why it's only 5 million downloads, whereas the other ones are 50 million.
Well, Steve, because it doesn't offer an OpenVPN server. It's just a client.
Oh, yes, and that's all anyone needs.
Okay, but the other ones you were talking about were clients for commercial services in many cases. So like Hotspot is a commercial VPN provider. So this is not, so be clear when you download this, folks, you still need an OpenVPN server. This is just a client.
Right. And I was going to say that. I didn't understand that those other ones are, so they're providing
Can't say
you
for all of them, but Hotspot, the, for sure, that's a commercial VPN service.
Right, yeah. right.
So I'm not sure Leaping Computer's trying to, I'm not sure what they're I think they're confusing the category as well. I'm not sure exactly what they're saying. There are a lot of bad VPN companies, that's for sure.
There are bad VPN companies, that, and what we now know is there are also bad VPN clients. That is, nobody who wants to use a VPN would want to have something that was tracking their location, using their camera and microphone and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, but there's nothing wrong with using an open VPN. I mean, this is OpenVPN, right? Use the client.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you need to have a server at the other end, otherwise.
Yes. And so I would separate the two. I would use no other client than this OpenVPN client for Android. It is on GitHub. It's produced by a reputable guy who's doing this in open source. That's all this thing is a clean, simple client, an OpenVPN client for Android. And then that was where I was headed with this, is then go choose whatever OpenVPN service you feel comfortable with, but there are like many. In fact, all of these VPNs are probably flavors of OpenVPN, because this problem, the whole VPNing problem, has been resolved. I mean, it's been solved already. So that was my takeaway, was the idea that there were this incredible number of clients where you've got to ask yourself, you know, and as you and I have often talked about, Leo, you know, why are they providing this to you for free? I wouldn't install anything on an Android device other than this one OpenVPN client, and then choose whatever service you like.
Most good VPN services have their own client. They have their own tied app. It's a dedicated app.
Yeah, although you are able to configure whatever you want to.
I guess so. Yeah. If you're using NordVPN or our sponsor ExpressVPN, you're using the Nord client or the ExpressVPN client, which means you don't have to do any configuration. It just connects to their servers.
Right.
So if you know what you're doing, OpenVPN for Android makes sense, but you have to know what the server is, you have to know how to configure it, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, that was my message. Just use OpenVPN. That this problem has been solved. You really don't need to look any further. You can have a clean client in your device.
Is DNS leakage something that the client does, or is it something that the service does, the server does?
Yes, it's something that the client does if it's not designed properly. And even OpenVPN, you can control with the config file whether DNS is routed through the tunnel or not routed through the tunnel. So it does need to be set up properly so that all of the network access routes through the tunnel and DNS isn't being provided by the OS's underlying platform service.
Yeah.
So it is worth verifying that, I mean, if you're concerned about that from a privacy leakage standpoint, that you've got a client that's doing it, it's configured the way you want it to be.
Right. There are other I know many companies don't like OpenVPN because of previous bugs, right? There are some companies that use other VPN technologies like IPsec, right?
There are. The problem with IPsec is that it can be difficult to get out of certain locations. Right, there are a lot of firewalls that block IPsec, whereas OpenVPN is able to run over standard ports because it just uses TLS and
HTTPS. Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
port 443. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Cool. So this, just to be clear, that's a great client for OpenVPN, but you have to have a server somewhere. that you're connected
Correct.
To. Many people do. I mean, lots of routers support it, for instance.
Yeah, it's what I've got in every one of my locations has an OpenVPN server and IPsec or PFSense, which is my preferred firewall. It's got, you know, OpenVPN server. You just click a button and then it's turned on. Right. So it's great. Right.
That's very handy. Very good, Steve Marino. We have concluded our proceedings for the day, for the week. Episode 698, in the can, as they say. You can find copies of Security Now, past and present, at Steve's site, grc.com, the Gibson Research Corporation. He also has, as he mentioned, Elaine Ferris's great transcripts. And as long as you're at grc.com, make sure you get a copy of SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, plus all the other freebies Steve gives away. There's lots of good content.
You can run it on an old computer, on one of your little wind-up shoe leather computers. It'll just go just fine.
If it's got BIOS, you can run it.
That's right.
You also might want to check out Squirrel, which is apparently 0.999999 ready.
It is this painfully, painfully close to happening. Yep.
Will you post your talk? Will there be a video? Will you post it?
Yes. There'll be a video. I'll post the talk. Before long, Laura and I are going to come up and hang out with you and Lisa. And we'll do the full presentation.
Good. We have to check this young lady out.
Yep.
If you want to get all of that, again, grc.com. Steve's Twitter handle is at SGGRC. You can DM him there. And, of course, he tweets the show notes before every show, so you can get a copy of those there at SGGRC. We have audio and video of the show, oddly enough, for no apparent reason, on our website, twit.tv/SN. You can also subscribe. You just search for Security Now, and you can get a copy of it automatically downloaded every Tuesday, the minute it's available. We do the show 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC on Tuesdays. If you want to watch us do it live, twit.tv/live has audio and video feeds. And if you do that, hang out in the chat room. That's where everybody else watching live is, at irc.twit.tv. Steve, we'll see you next week on Security Now.
My friend, till then, bye.
Security Now.